Good evening, everybody. It is my duty as the head of the Vihara to welcome you and welcome Bante Ajahn Brahmawanso. Ajahn Brahmawanso is actually not a stranger for us because he brought up in this area. He used to live in Acton, and his loving mother also used to live in Acton. At the same time, he was schooling at Latima in Hammersmith. So therefore, he is not a stranger for us at all. But it is customary for me to give a little introduction about our speaker. He is world-renowned monk and well-known speaker to many of us. Ajahn Brahmawanso was born in London. He lived in Acton. In 1951 he was born. He regarded himself a Buddhist at the age of 17. Through his reading of Buddhist books while still at school, his interest in Buddhism and meditation flourished while studying theoretical physics at Cambridge University. After completing his degree and teaching for a year, he traveled to Thailand to become a monk. He was ordained in Bangkok at the age of 23 by the abbot of Wat Saket. Subsequently, he spent 9 years studying and training in the forest meditation tradition of the revered Venerable Ajahn Chah. In 1983, he was asked to assist in the establishing of a forest monastery near Perth, Western Australia. The monastery, Bodhayana Monastery, has approximately 20 resident monks. Ajahn Brahm is currently the abbot of the monastery. He is also the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, the spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of Victoria, and the spiritual director of the Chittabhavana Buddhist Hermitage in Bundaboo in New South Wales. Today we are very privileged that he is going to give a talk, and we all are delighted. So many people are here. You all are very welcome. Bante, with my utmost respect, I would like to welcome you and I would like to invite you to deliver your Dhamma talk.
Very good. It's always a pleasure to come back to my home turf, because around this area, I wasn't always a monk. A few girlfriends have lived around this area. I frequented a few of the pubs, which shows that I wasn't born as a monk. Even though my mother said I had no hair when I came out of her womb, which was a sign. It was a sign. But it's also good to see just Buddhism growing in my home country of England. Actually, I don't know if I have a home country anymore. It's very strange that I've been overseas for such a long time. But every time I come back to England, it's like coming home. But then, you know, on the way back, you go to Thailand, and I think I'm going home. And now I've been to Sri Lanka many times. As soon as I land in Colombo Airport, I think I'm going home. And then I go to Singapore, and I've got so many friends in Singapore and Malaysia, I'm going home again. And then I go to Australia and I'm coming home again. I just don't know where I belong. Which is nice, actually, to show that in our modern world, the barriers between peoples and places is coming down. And we are bringing down barriers, Berlin walls, and lines which separate human beings. And that's a wonderful thing for Buddhism to actually to help with. Because when we bring down those barriers which separate peoples, which separate races and genders and other people, it creates this beautiful, harmonious world. And one thing which I've been very active with in Australia, and hopefully that this is happening in, in Europe as well, is to bring down even the barriers which separate the different Buddhist traditions. Because sometimes, you know, as a Theravada Buddhist, and especially for those of you who are Sri Lankan Buddhists, sometimes you think that maybe my Buddhism is the best. And if you think like that, you're making a very big mistake. Because sometimes people think that Theravada Buddhism is the best because we have the original teachings of the Buddha. We've added a lot, even Theravada Buddhists. We've added stuff. Modern research, and I keep in contact with what's happening in modern research, we have added things, which is interesting to know. So we don't have the original teachings, we have what we've added on top of it. And Mahayana Buddhists, they have added things as well. Vajrayana, we've added things. So we can't say that any tradition has the original teachings. In fact, we can combine those different traditions and find out what we have in common. And what we have in common is very likely to be those original teachings. Sometimes people say that Mahayana Buddhist is the best type of Buddhism because it's the most compassionate. But I've travelled around the world and I've done so much work, working so hard teaching, that sometimes people call me, and I know this in Singapore, they call me the Theravada monk with a Mahayana heart. Because I really, you know, do really help and care for other people. So, who is the most compassionate tradition? Traditions aren't compassionate, people are. So you don't say that my tradition is better than yours because it's a more compassionate tradition. It's whether the people are compassionate. And you see in all traditions, whether it's Mahayana or Theravada, there are compassionate people and there are selfish people in all those traditions. So we can't say our tradition is better because it is the most compassionate. And sometimes people say, especially in the Tibetan tradition, that it is for the most intelligent and it's the fastest tradition, the diamond tradition. That's what Vajrayana really means. But look, people who want to go on the fast tradition are people who want to take shortcuts. And I tell you, shortcuts waste a lot of time. Not this last time, but a couple of years ago when I was in Sri Lanka, I was giving a talk at Peradeniya in Kandy. And after the talk was completed, Kandy's in the middle of Sri Lanka, and it's mostly of Sri Lanka, so you know what I'm talking about. My host was taking me back to Colombo, where I was staying the night. Halfway between Kandy and Colombo, he decided to take a shortcut. And this was a man who was brought up in Sri Lanka. And he's a local boy. And we ended up along the Gaul Road just north of Kalutara. We were 4 hours late getting back. Now that's typical of a shortcut. Shortcuts waste a lot of time. So anyone traditionally says, we've got the shortcut, you're going to waste a lot of time on that shortcut. So we're not, in any way, the fastest way. The journey of Buddhism is not a fast way. We are the patient way, the gentle way. This is not some sort of race to get to Nibbana first. It's actually learning how to be still and learning how to go nowhere and just to be. Many of you know in your life you've always been travelers, always going to the next destination, which is why we never find peace in our hearts. We're always going on to the next thing. Just going back to my childhood, my first school was in Acton, Derwentwater School, if anyone knows that one. That was the primary school where I lived. And at that primary school, we had an examination called the 11 Plus. This was, how many years ago? 50 years ago. In that 11 Plus examination, my teachers said, if you do well in 11 Plus, you'll go to a good school. So, you know, study. Do a little bit of homework. And, you know, I did really well in my 11 Plus. So even though my parents were very poor, I got to Latimer. It's a very good school. So as soon as I got to Latimer, I thought, okay, I'm set, I've gone to a good school. I said, no, you're not set, you've got to do even more work. Because when you're about 14 or 15, you have another series of examinations, the O-levels. Do you still have the O-levels? Okay, your GCEs, whatever it is. But anyway, at that time, I was really interested in soccer. I love going on, at Ravenscourt Park at lunchtime with my friends, playing soccer, or in the local park in Acton, playing soccer. But my parents and my teachers said, stop chasing a football. Stay at home and do your homework. Because if you do well at O-levels, you'll be happy. That's what I thought. So I actually did that. I followed the advice. I stopped playing soccer. I worked really hard, did my homework, and I did really well in O-levels. But you know, something strange happened. I wasn't happy. Because I had to now do A-levels, which were even harder. But didn't matter, because my parents, actually my father died before I took my A-levels. My mother and my teacher said, look, yeah, but A-levels, that's really important. If you do well at A-levels, you go to a good university. And once you go to a good university, you're set, you're happy. So this time I wasn't chasing a football, I was chasing girls. Don't go to the parties, don't go to the dances, stay at home and do your homework. And again, I followed their advice. And I did really well at A-levels, enough to go to a good university like Cambridge. But was I happy? No, because now you had to do even harder exams. And I learned a lesson for all you people at school or university. If you pass an exam, there's another one coming next year. So if you fail an exam, you're finished. So the sooner you fail, the quicker you can relax. But I never knew that. But one thing which happened when I was at university, people keep saying, if you pass a degree, get a degree from Cambridge, you really are set for life. All be happy. Get a good job, get a good girl, have a nice salary, you'll be set. You've got your degree from Cambridge. But this was the time when I stopped following other people's advice. I started to get suspicious. Because I started looking at other people who had finished their degrees. Were they happy yet? No, they weren't. They were chasing something else. As soon as you finish your university, then you got a job. And it was hard work. You had to get a place to live. So many of my friends who were a bit older, they had a flat or an apartment. They're having to save up to get a better apartment or to get a car. And as soon as they got an apartment or a car, and then they were looking for their partner in life. And they told me, when I meet her, the girl of my dreams, then I'll be happy. When I meet the boy who is destined for me in heaven, then I'll be happy. And I saw many of my friends who had fallen in love and got married. And were they happy? Not at all. But what happened? The older friends, they said, okay, we're married now. When we have kids, that will actually fill up our family. When we have kids, then we'll be happy. You saw them once they had kids. No sleep at night. Worry about it. It costs you a lot of money having a kid. It's much cheaper having a dog. It is cheaper having a dog. They're much more friendly to you. When you go away, you can just take them into a kennel. You can't do that with your children. Take them into a kennel if you want to go 2 weeks to Sri Lanka. Wouldn't it be great to have kennels for? No, I shouldn't go on there. I get into trouble. But they told me, said, okay, yeah, we have kids, but when the kids grow up, then we'll be happy. Now that might be some of you in that situation, looking after children, you think, I'll get my kids well educated, make sure they're set up in life, and have a nice partner. When my kids get married and leave home, then I'll be happy. But I saw people whose kids had left home. They weren't happy yet. This is actually my generation now. I was with quite a few people in Cambridge. Now they say, I've only got a couple of years and I'll retire. Because when I retire, then I'll be happy. So they're still searching for this elusive happiness. And as soon as they retire, when they get old, have you ever noticed, even looking around this temple, most of the people here are old people. You look at people in churches, they're mostly old people. Even in mosques, in synagogues. Why do old people go to church or to temples? Because they think, once I die, then I'll be happy. Go to heaven. So your happiness, you make a bit more good karma, because you know, you better hurry up, you haven't got much time left. Because of that, you find out that most people, their happiness is always sometime in the future. Always, you know, when it's the holiday time, when it's the weekend, you know, when I fall in love, or when I fix up this problem, when I pay off the mortgage. It's always sometime in the future is our happiness. And for me, I saw through that when I was at university. So if happiness has to be found now. And so it was wonderful as a Buddhist. When I became a Buddhist, one of my experiences which changed much of my life was going to the Cambridge University Buddhist Society and doing meditation for the very first time. Only 5 minutes. And that 5 minutes gave me a taste of peace and stillness. And that was the first time in my life, 18 years, not very long, I tasted such peace and stillness. I didn't understand Buddhism that much, but I knew that that was the most important thing. That was happiness. And I never needed to pass any exam for that. I did not need another person. I did not need wealth to experience that peace. And that taste of freedom was what took me deeper into Buddhism and meditation. It was a happiness and fulfillment right here and right now. And that made me delight in this path of Buddhism. Because all the other religions which I had investigated, they were always saying, yes, you'll be happy later on when you get to heaven. It's just finding out which one had the right heaven. It's like, you know, going to the races, to the Epsom Derby. Which horse should you back? So, not knowing which horse to back, you know, which religion to follow, I had to follow the one which you could feel from your own experience gave you a great sense of peace and stillness. And that's an important part of the Buddhist teachings. These things are to be experienced rather than just to be believed. Unfortunately, many people just, you know, follow beliefs. And they just follow what's said in the books. They just follow what the teacher says. And that's not Buddhism. I was saying in the Thai temple this afternoon, I know some of you are following me, so you're going to hear some of the same stories again. And actually, that many of you were here 2 years ago when I gave a talk, but because most of you are old people, and I do like talking to the elderly, because they forgot what I said 2 years ago. You can say the same joke again. I remember this person, he actually went to the doctor. And the doctor said, I'm sorry, but there's two very bad diseases you've got. You've got cancer. I said, oh my gee, cancer, that's terrible. What else have I got? He said, you've got Alzheimer's disease too. He said, well, it's a good job I haven't got cancer. So, but learning actually how to understand Buddhism by an experience actually was why I became a Buddhist monk. And that experience of like peace, of freedom, is something which is not described in any book. The book tells you how to get to that place. And one of the stories I like telling, and again I told it in the Thai temple this afternoon, is about the restaurant, you know, here in London, which opened up recently. And there was a Sri Lankan man, a professor at university. He heard about this very, very expensive, good restaurant. And he decided to try and get a seat there. So he rang up the restaurant and asked when the next reservation was available. 2 months before he could get a seat. It was that popular. So he put his name down. And 2 months went past. It was a date, time for his reservation at this incredible, wonderful restaurant. So he put on a nice suit. He went there. They checked his name on the list. Yes, he had a reservation. So the maitre d' took him to his table. And as he sat down, the maitre d', or the, called over the waiter, and the waiter gave this gentleman the menu. And you wouldn't believe this menu was on thick parchment. And the lettering was in gold, with beautiful calligraphy, as you would expect in a top restaurant. And the professor took the menu and said thank you, and proceeded to eat the menu, and paid his bill, and left. Because the professor did not know the difference between the menu and the food. In the same way, there are too many Buddhists in England who don't know the difference between the sutras and peace. The menu and the meal. So all of the teachings, these are menus. And if all you ever do is eat menus, you haven't really touched and understood what Buddhism is. So we actually do something. We feel the peace in our heart. We experience it. We keep our precepts, our pansil. How many people here keep pansil all of your life? Anyone put your hand up? Keep pansil. Very good girl. So what type of Buddhist are you? Look, taste what keeping pansil, the five precepts, is like. Because when you take these five precepts, you feel so much peace and so much happiness. That's what the Buddha said. He actually gave it a name. He called it Anavajrasukha, the blameless bliss. So you don't keep these five precepts to go to heaven in your next life. You keep these five precepts to go to heaven now. It's a beautiful sense of peace and happiness in your life. That's what the Buddha said. But why don't people keep five precepts? What's the point of lying when people can't trust you anymore? What's the point of drinking alcohol? The last time I was in Sri Lanka, Sri Lankan Vihara, in January, I mentioned to your president, Rajapaksa, some research which I learnt about 12 months ago. I went to a conference in New Zealand, and there a professor from UCLA told me that the idea that drinking red wine is good for your health has been overturned. And I'll tell you what happened. The original study was done in California, and a large number of people were researched. And they found a clear correlation between those who drank red wine and low incidence of cardiac problems. So it appeared that drinking red wine lessened your chance of getting heart problems. However, they looked at the research again, because people who drink red wine are usually the people in California in the higher economic bracket. Most people will drink beer, who had in the lower socioeconomic bracket. So what they decided to do was just to limit the study to that socioeconomic bracket, the people on the same income levels who drank red wine and the same income levels who didn't drink red wine. And then they found the same income levels drinking red wine gave you an increase in your heart disease. Really, it wasn't the red wine which was causing an increase in your health. It was the money which a person was making which allowed them to buy red wine. Because people on that income level were able to afford good health cover. They were able to look after their body, going to a gym. It was the money which was increasing their health, not the wine. In the same way that a few years ago, another research paper was published where people who smoked cigarettes had a far less incidence of Alzheimer's disease. And so the cigarette companies were saying that if you smoke cigarettes, you're not going to get dementia. And it was true, it was very clear. Until someone pointed out the reason why you have a low incidence of Alzheimer's for people who smoke was because people who smoke don't live long enough to get Alzheimer's disease. So you've got to be careful with these statistics. The reason why red wine was associated with good health is because people with red wine could afford better health cover. It's the money, not the red wine. So when you took off the money, the red wine was bad for your health, not good. Which is why many governments are actually trying to lessen the alcohol limits for people who drive. And I think some jurisdictions, they're trying to take it to 0% alcohol level. In other words, even a sort of small glass, they're going to try and ban you from driving. And there's a good reason for that. In my own experience, you know, one of the most tragic funeral services I ever gave was for a Chinese girl. A single child from a Chinese family. And the Chinese family had worked so hard to give their daughter a good education. Sacrificed everything. And she worked so hard. She got a scholarship to a university over in Australia. She graduated and got residence. And once she had her first job, she saved and brought her mother and father to this new land of opportunity. And her parents had only been in Australia 1 week when someone driving a car drunk had gone into the pavement where they were walking and killed their daughter. And the parents, the mother and father, who could speak no English, all their dreams, their life had been shattered because the person driving the car wasn't drunk but was over the limit. When you see the danger in these things, you just don't want to do it. So you don't need to drink. The other story I tell was another story about someone who had been drink driving. And again, I think you may have heard this story here before because it's one of my favourite ones. He was in Sydney. And he'd been drinking at work, and he drove home one evening. Even though he'd been drinking, he took a chance. But that day, the Sydney police were doing a crackdown on drink driving. They blocked off a whole road, and they were testing every driver along that road for their alcohol level. It was a trap. And when he drove there, he drove right into it, and he realized he couldn't do a U-turn. Because if you do a U-turn, it's an admission of guilt. So he knew he was over the limit. He just had to wait. Wait his turn to be tested, knowing that he was done for. When it got to his turn, in Australia, you step outside of the car. And the policeman gives you this little tube to blow into. So he got out of his car. Policeman handed him the tube. Can you please blow into this, sir? And just as he took hold of the apparatus, the breathalyzer, there was a sound of a car crash. Another car had been travelling slightly too fast and had gone into the rear of the car in front of him. And the policeman heard the sound of this collision. And he said to this man, "Sir, it's more important that I look after this road accident than check your alcohol level." And he took the breathalyzer tube back and said, "Get in your car and go home." He thought he was so lucky. He came literally within a second of getting caught. But the story hasn't ended yet. The following morning, he woke up in his home with a hangover. And the reason he woke up was someone was ringing his doorbell and they just would not stop. So he hurriedly got dressed, opened his door, and saw two policemen waiting outside. Whenever you see two policemen outside the door of your home, even if you're a monk, you get a bit scared. What have I done wrong? And he knew he'd been drink driving the night before, but he thought, according to law, they can't do anything about me now because I'm not driving. He said, "What do you want, sir?" And the policeman said, "Would you mind, sir, if we look inside your garage?" And he thought to himself, "There's nothing in my garage, it's my car, I'm not a burglar, there's no stolen goods there." "Sure you can." So he took them over to his garage and opened the door. As soon as he opened the door of his garage, he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage, there was a police car. He'd been so drunk when they said, get in your car and go home. He got in the wrong car. He left his car at the roadblock. Police were missing one. They soon checked out where the car was. So that's the danger of drink driving. I think he's still in jail. And that's a true story that happened. So, now what do you want to drink for anyway? I gave up drinking when I was at Cambridge. And I thought when I was giving up drinking, you know, you're a student, you know, you like sort of fun and games and parties and dances and stuff. I thought that was going to be a really big sacrifice. Who wants to go out with, you know, somebody who doesn't drink, you know, in England? But I thought, no, I'm going to stick to my precepts. I'm not going to drink. I thought I'd never get invited to any more parties. The truth was, I got invited to even more parties. The reason why? They wanted somebody sober to drive them home. And that was me. So if you want to be more popular, be sober. So I gave it up. And to this day, you know, I tell other people, you actually have far more fun in life. Sort of actually being a really good Buddhist. You're actually more peaceful. Just try it. If you try it, it's amazing that you get more happiness and more peace in life. And I tell this to young people. This is Buddhism for the youth. If you go to a party, when is the best time of the party? Now, the last part of it, you've got your girlfriend or your boyfriend sitting in the corner. You know what you're up to. When I was drinking, I didn't remember that part. The best part of the party was lost. But when you were sober, you really enjoyed your canoodling. For want of a better word. So isn't that true? So what are you taking alcohol for? You're missing out on the fun. So these days, I tell people that. And over in Perth, our Buddhist society over there has got over 1,000 members. About 400 of them have determined the 5 precepts for life. They don't just keep them for one day. Forever. And they're having a great time. So, you know, most of you are Sri Lankan. Your Buddhist is in your genes. It's in your blood. So do it properly. You have much more fun in life. Much more peace. Much more health. So this is why that in Buddhism we just... Our job is actually to test it out and find out if it really works or not. And that's what I did. And I've been testing out all the time and find it's a brilliant path. A wonderful way. But not only it gives you more happiness in life, it just gives you more meaning in life. And it solves many of the other ethical problems of life. You know that some of the problems with our Western system, it has been based sort of on Christian law, and it's very the old type of Christianity, where, you know, we have almost like the sacredness of life. I was just talking with the Venerable earlier. When I say, what should we talk about? Let's talk about some Buddhist issues here. You know, like abortion, euthanasia, and Buddhism. Or like, how many of you got dogs and cats when you have to take the dog or cat to the vet and have it put down? Is that being a good Buddhist or not? Now, how we face those problems in Buddhism is brilliant. When... I teach these things, other people say, wow, that really makes sense and it's practical. What a beautiful way of applying these Buddhist teachings. They actually work. So you've got a cat with cancer. You take it to the vet. You spend money trying to look after it. And then one day, the vet says, there's no possibility of your cat surviving. Your cat is in pain. Can I inject it and put it down? What should you do as a Buddhist? Put your hands up if you think the cat should be put down. Put your hands up if you think you shouldn't put it down. Put your hands up if you realize it's why can you decide for the cat? Isn't it the cat's choice? So I tell people, why don't you ask the cat? Now that may seem funny to you, But that's just serious. Many times, one of the cases, this lady had a dog, had cancer, and eventually the vet said, look, you've got to put it down. And so she followed my advice. She said, give me a few moments with my dog. So she took the dog into a corner, and she just stayed with it and looked in the dog's eyes and asked the dog, do you want to die? She just asked the question, and she felt the answer. I mean, these are people you love. Some of these cats and dogs are like children to you. When you love someone that much, you do have a connection with them. And if you ask the question, do you want to die? You will know the answer immediately. You'll feel it inside. It's no psychic power, it's just what happens when you're close to something or someone. So she asked the dog, do you want to die? And she felt very clearly, no. So she took the dog back to the vet and said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to allow you to put it down, I'm taking it home. And the dog said, you Buddhists are so stupid and cruel, I thought you were compassionate. But she took the criticism and took the dog home. After 3 months, the dog made a full recovery, and she took the dog back to the vet, and the vet said, you Buddhists are so wise and kind. The dog knew what to do, but if you look at that dog or cat and you feel that the dog has had enough, you feel the cat is really hurting and doesn't want to stand anymore, then you can tell the vet, the cat says, give me the injection. The dog says, put me down. You are just conveying the dog's choice, not your own choice. And I've done that many times. This has been practicing like this over 5 or 10 years probably in Perth. I had amazing results. And Buddhists feel that they're not breaking any precept. They're not killing an animal because it's not your choice. You should respect those animals and let them decide. Most times the animals want to live, but they come to a point where they're in such great pain. You have to let them go. Have to let them make the decision. So it's the same with euthanasia. In euthanasia, every time that there is a survey, in most of these countries, it's usually 70-80% or more, say yes, there will come a time when my quality of life is no good. And I don't want to keep around any longer. There's no point to it. Most people feel that way. So what does the Buddha say about euthanasia? I mentioned to the Venerable that the first person in the world who was given legally assisted euthanasia was a Buddhist in Australia. I never met him personally, but one of my monks did. And they asked him, why were you planning to do that? And he said that he had some degenerative disease which left him bedridden. He had no quality of life and no hope of any recovery. But being a Buddhist, he was quite happy to tolerate that situation, however long it took to die. But he said what he couldn't tolerate was that his wife had to give him 24 hours care and had no life for herself. He said, I'm doing this to free my wife and to give her a life. Can you fault that? Sometimes we have these situations where we look at it and we think maybe that's the appropriate thing to do. But certainly people should have that freedom of choice. As the Buddha said, we are the owners of our karma. Not the legal system. The legal system should not take ownership of our karma. We are the owners of our karma. And so really we should have that choice. And whichever choice you make, we learn from those results. Sometimes in making choices, which is something which often happens in life, how do we make choices? First of all, there is no such thing as a right choice and a wrong choice. They are just different choices. Calling them right or wrong is a simplification. It doesn't make any sense to me. And when you call one choice a right choice and the other choice a wrong choice, it brings up so much fear and difficulty that people become paralyzed. They can't make any choice. But when we realize there's no such thing as a right choice or a wrong choice, it's just we go to a different path. Now, how many ways, you know, can you get to Acton from here? There's two or three ways I know, and I haven't lived in this place for 35 years. There's many different paths. So which is the right way, which is the wrong way? It's like when you're in the motorway. Which is the fastest lane? I'll tell you which is the fastest lane on the M25. The one you are not in. That always goes quicker than you do. But there is no right lane or wrong lane in life. It's just different lanes. And we, just as Buddhists, we, whatever choice we make it work. We make something out of it. Whatever happens, we can always make use of it. And that's one of the great things about Buddhism. It's such a positive thing. We know there's no such thing as a wrong choice or a right choice. If we do, and I said this before, I actually didn't say this in the Thai temple. If we do, as it were, tread in the dog shit, then it's not a wrong choice. I mentioned the word shit, and I mentioned the word shit here before, because in the Arana Vibhanga Sutra, you can check this up if you like, the Buddha said, monks, you should teach Buddhism in the local language. And this is Chiswick. It is not Colombo. So suppose walking home from here, you tread in a dog poo and you get the shit all over your shoes. Is that a wrong choice? Not necessarily. It depends what you do with it. And I tell people, if you do tread in a dog shit, never scrape it off your shoes. Always take it home with you first. And you may have an apple tree in your back garden. Scrape it off there. Because if you scrape it off under your apple tree, it means a year's time from now, your apples will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. But the important thing is, if this is what you do, is that when you eat those apples, always remember what you're really eating. It is dog shit, but transformed in the juiciest, sweetest of apples. Now you can understand what I mean by this. There's no such thing as a wrong choice or a right choice, because if you do get the shit of life, you can make use of that. So it really doesn't depend on which path you turn in life. What really matters is what you make of that path. Which means there's no right choice or wrong choice, it's just a choice, that's all. And it's how you work with the results of that choice. And so saying that, it takes away the fear of choosing. You just make a choice and make it work. It's like some of you maybe choosing, you know, some young people over here, who you're going to live with in life. Who's your partner going to be in life? It doesn't really matter. You just choose a boy, choose a girl and make it work. Because as I said in the Thai temple, boys, they're all the same. Girls, maybe a different chassis, but the engine inside is exactly the same as every other girl. It's just the covering. The packaging is different, that's all. And that is true. So just choose one and make it work. It's good enough. So sometimes people... It's amazing actually that, you know, in choosing your partner in life, people spend so much time choosing their partner in life. You know, you go out with them, find out what they're like. In fact, you spend more time choosing your partner in life than you do choosing your car. However, when you've got your car, you take care of it for so many years. Your partner, maybe the first couple of years. There's an old saying, in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of them, shouting and screaming. But why is it? We spend so much energy and effort choosing our partner, and we get it wrong. Why is that? Because actually we haven't got it wrong. We make a choice and we don't make it work afterwards. And this is actually why we can make anything work if we really try hard. One of, again, the meaningful stories about how we make things work in life, if we really have to, was a story of some Buddhists, actually a Buddhist girl with a Christian husband, who came over to Western Australia, to Perth, many years ago, because he was a mining engineer and is much of mining up in the north of Western Australia. So they came out from Canada on a 2-year contract. He worked up in the mines and she was in Perth, and she was a Buddhist, so she came to my monastery and temple. And after their contract was finished, they had to go back to Toronto where they lived. And they had a wonderful idea. They hadn't had any children yet. They sold the little house which they bought, and with the money, instead of buying an air ticket, they bought a small boat. And they were going to sail from Perth around Australia, over the Pacific to Vancouver. And when they reached Vancouver, they were going to sell their boat and they would have enough money for their mortgage. And it was an adventure for them. You know, two young people sailing through the beautiful islands of the South Pacific. And they teamed up with another Canadian pair returning home. So there was these two families on this voyage of a lifetime. They managed to reach Vancouver and they sent a letter to me saying they had arrived safely, but also mentioning a really interesting thing which happened on the voyage. The engine failed and stopped working. It cut out and they were becalmed in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean, even if you could get a signal, there's no AA to come with roadside assistance. So you have to fix up that boat yourself. So the two men went into the engine compartment to try and fix up the fault. And if you've ever tried to fix up engines, sometimes some motors just do not want to be fixed. And they were trying to fix up this engine and getting more and more frustrated. And when you become frustrated, you usually become so irritated you start saying mean things at each other. And that irritation soon turned to anger. And the anger became rage, as they were shouting at each other. And it got so bad that one of these men threw down his wrench on the floor and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." Anger makes you so crazy that he went into his cabin, washed, changed into his good clothes, packed his suitcase, and appeared on deck carrying his two suitcases, about to leave. And it was only when the two women burst out laughing that he realized, as he looked around him, there was ocean as far as the eye could see in all directions. There was no place to go. So what did he do? He just went back into his cabin, unpacked, changed into his work clothes, went back into the engine compartment to help with the problem. There was no choice. And they did fix the engine. And they became friends again. And they remained friends. It's a beautiful story. Because if there was a place where he could run away, there would still be enemies to this day. When there was no place to go, no place to run, there's always an opportunity to fix up the problem. Our world is too small a place to run away. We have to fix up problems. We've got no place to go. And that story shows, when we do have that commitment to live together, we can always fix it up, no matter what the problem is. Now that's a very positive story in life about how to deal with the problems when we make so-called difficult choices. We can always make it work if we are committed and if we manage to have that commitment not to run away, to face our problems, learn from them, grow from them, and make them work. but just on the subject of anger. And anger does cause so many problems in our life. And it does create disharmony. It does separate people. It does separate the different types of Buddhism. It does separate husband from wife. But the wonderful thing which I knew about Buddhism was that it gave you practical methods of just overcoming that anger. So it was never a problem for you anymore. So you didn't need to make choices based on anger, which we would regret later on. And one of the stories, and I don't think I've told this here for a while, at least not for 2 years. That's the last time I was here. There was once this man, this husband, this Sri Lankan man, and he had the afternoon off work. And his wife was making dinner. And his wife looked at him and said, "Darling, now I need some eggs for dinner. And you've got the afternoon off work. Would you mind, darling, going to the market and buying some eggs for me?" He said, "Certainly, darling, I don't mind, but I've never been to the market before. Can you actually tell me how to get there and what to do?" So his wife gave him instructions, gave him the basket of money, and sent him off to the market to buy some eggs for dinner. And he was happily walking into the market, and as soon as he got into the marketplace, this young man approached him, went right up to him, and said, "You smell like dog shit. And by the way, you've also got a face like a camel. The back end of a camel, that is." And that was really offensive. And the husband said, "I don't even know you. Why are you calling me these terrible names?" And that just started this young man off. He started cursing and abusing this husband in words which even I don't know, because I'm a monk. I live a very pure life. All I've got is dog shit and camel face. I'm sure there's many worse things in Acton and Chiswick and Hammersmith these days. You just have to imagine what those words would be. But this guy was being abused in the marketplace, in public, and he'd done nothing. And the husband got so upset that he turned around and walked home. And as soon as he got back into the house, his wife says, "You're home early, darling." "Yeah, I know. Don't ever send me to that stupid market again. People are just so uncivilized." And he was so upset and angry, as you would be if you'd been abused in public. And when his wife calmed him down, she said, "What happened?" And as soon as the husband explained this young man abusing him and calling him all sorts of terrible names, that's when the wife said, "Oh, him. He says he does that to everybody, because when he was very young, he had an accident. He fell on his head, he hit his head, and he's brain damaged. The poor young man will never go to school. He will never find a partner in life or get a job. He's brain damaged, he's crazy. Sometimes he abuses me, sometimes he abuses other people. That's just a crazy guy." And as soon as the husband realized he'd been abused by someone with brain damage, all his anger disappeared. And when the wife saw all the anger disappeared, she looked at her husband and said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." And he said, "Okay." And she said, "Don't mind that crazy guy, he's got brain damage." He said, "Okay, I won't. I understand now." So he went back into the market, and the crazy guy saw him. "Hold your noses, everyone. Here comes dog poo. Close your eyes. Here comes camel face." But it didn't matter now, because the poor guy was brain damaged. And the husband went straight up to the egg store, being abused and shouted out all the way. The lady selling the eggs said, "Don't mind him. He's brain damaged. I heard he hit his head. Isn't it a shame he'll never be able to go to school or go to work? Poor thing." And all the time they were being abused. But because he knew he was being abused by someone who was insane with brain damage, it didn't matter anymore. So he got the eggs and walked home, no problem at all. The moral of that story is this. If you go home from work and your husband abuses you, just assume he must have hit his head that day. He's temporarily insane. Because getting angry and abusing other people is insanity in Buddhism. Temporary insanity. So if your wife calls you all sorts of names and abuses you, she must be crazy. So don't take it personally. I thought it was a beautiful way of dealing with anger. So you don't have to get upset at what's said about you and get angry about what's said about you. Because after all, when someone abuses you, you have a choice to get upset or remain peaceful. When you realize you have a choice, this is about choices, why not make a wise choice and not allow other people to take away your happiness? Why allow other people to control your happiness? As a Buddhist monk wearing these clothes, I often get abused. Sometimes when I'm looking for the toilet in the airport, someone says, you should go into that one, the women's toilets, because that's what you look like. They've got a point, because actually I do look much more like the sign on the woman's toilet than the man's toilet. But am I going to get angry at that? Of course not. I'm not going to allow other people to control my happiness. So what other people say and do, I realize my happiness is my choice. I'm not going to allow anybody to control my happiness. They can say whatever they like. Not say whatever they like, they can do whatever I like. You know, some people, they don't turn up on time. Sometimes that people let you down. Why allow that to destroy your happiness today? If some people do some bad karma, that's their bad karma. I'm not going to take it on myself. Why allow life to take away your happiness? I don't know how many of you have suffered in the recession. Why allow recession to take away your happiness? However much you've lost, I can guarantee you this, you've got more than me. I can guarantee that one. So you don't need that much to be happy. You don't need that much, because especially in times of recession, that's when you realize the real currency of happiness. And it's not the money you have, it's the friends and relations who love you. That's your wealth. Because in times of difficulty or tragedy, who comes around to bring you a meal, to give you a place to sleep, to look after you? It's your friends and relations. That's why those of you who are brought up in the villages of Sri Lanka or Thailand or wherever, you that you never worried about losing a job or even illness. There was always a cousin, there was always a relation who would go and look after you. You had what we call social capital. Wherever you go, whatever happened, you'd be the people who cared and loved you, who would look after you. So in any times of economic difficulty, always say, remember the social capital. And build the social capital, your friends, your loved ones, your relationships, because those will be there for you in any times of difficulty, when the money will not be there. We call it just making good karma, being kind, being generous, looking after one another. And when you do that, you don't have to worry about anything. As a monk, whenever I go anywhere, I don't ever carry any health insurance. Because I know if I get sick, if I even cough, there's so many doctors in this vihara, they'll be fighting to try and give me the medicine. And this has happened several times. I've coughed in public, and the next day I've got about 10 bottles of cough mixture. And everyone who gives it to me says, now, I've got this specially for you. Now, this is the best cough medicine you can get in the chemist. This is Sri Lankan cough medicine, herbal. It's really good. This is Ayurvedic. This is Thai. This is Chinese. And you must take it because I brought this specially for you. And they won't leave me alone until I promise to take it. And so when I've taken from every of these bottles, that's when I really get sick. But it doesn't matter.
That's because you've got a huge amount of social capital. People actually care for you and they love you and they look after you. That's why I don't need money. That's why you don't need health insurance. Because you've got this great social capital which you've built up as a monk. Now you can understand, in times of recession, you have got a choice. Build up your social capital and you've got nothing at all to be afraid of or worry about. If you lose your job, your friends will be able to find you something. As long as you're not too demanding and choosy. So remember this other story of this man. This man who, the young man, they couldn't find him a job he liked. So they got him a job. One of their friends of a friend owned a restaurant. So they got him a job as a waiter. Actually quite good money. And it wasn't heavy work. You get lots of tips. But after half a day, he said, I can't stand this any longer. Why is that, they asked. All day I'm giving people this beautiful food and I can't eat any of it. It's torture to me. You can imagine it would be, serving this beautiful food and you can't eat any of it. So his friends thought, okay, you can be the cashier of the restaurant. You don't have to look at the food, just take the money. So he went to work as a cashier. After half a day, he couldn't stand it any longer. He gave it away. Why is that? His friends asked. I'm counting all of this money and none of it is mine. It's torture. So here's one of these guys, you know, that is so hard to get a job for. His friends thought and contemplated and they said, we found you the perfect job. You can be the cemetery attendant. The guy who sits in the box in the front of this cemetery to make sure that no one does any harm or any graffiti on the graves. They said, it pays well, you don't have to see food, you don't have to see any money. So surely you can do that job. So he tried it. After half a day, he couldn't stand it any longer. And they asked why. He said, I spent all morning sitting on a chair, and I saw all the people lying down in front of me. And I couldn't stand it any longer, so I wanted to lay down as well. That's an old story about laziness. So when you have social capital, there's always something you can do, something you can make. We're not so demanding. It's amazing just what you can do in life to be able to create some happiness and peace. And also going back to those ethical questions. I actually went on a tangent there. When it's either on euthanasia or already sort of covered with the killing of animals, especially, you know, putting a dog down. When it's euthanasia, there's something similar there. It still has to be a person's choice. Just sort of say where you ask a dog, you ask a person. Fortunately, in Buddhism, we don't have this idea of the sacredness of life. That is the influence of the Abrahamic religions of Christianity, which actually muddle up the thinking. When there is a divine law, it often stands in the way of compassion. When we think that life is sacred and we shouldn't play God, part of us thinks this divine law is important. But the other part of us is compassion and kindness. We think it's cruel to keep this person going. Fortunately, as Buddhists, we don't have divine law. Fortunately, as Buddhists, all those things we read about in the words of the Buddha, they are the menus, they are the advice, they are not commandments. These are the ones which make us look very clearly and very deeply. All of these rules, they are like the red traffic lights. The red traffic lights, you're supposed to stop, but not all the time. If this evening, after giving a talk, I have a heart attack, and you put me in your car, I hope you go through those red traffic lights, please. But you go through those red traffic lights very carefully, making sure it's not dangerous. In emergency, you're supposed to go through those red traffic lights. The red traffic lights are just a guide to be kept at most times, but they're not absolutes. In the same, the instruction and advice you hear and read in the books, there's advice, guidelines, but in the end, you have to make your choice.
Now, all are always exceptions, which is why, as a Buddhist, we don't have these hard and fast laws. Euthanasia is always wrong or always right. We have to have that nuance there to take every case on its merits, but have the freedom there to make that choice when it's needed. As I said, you are the owner of the karma, not the law, not the book. You are the owner of karma. So you make those choices. And when you make the choices, which the talk is supposed to be about, the Buddha said there's four things you should contemplate before you make a choice. It's called the four agati. To make sure you're not making a choice out of personal desire, not out of ill will, not out of stupidity, and most importantly, not out of fear. In other words, it's not what's in it for you, it's what's the best for everybody. Not out of ill will, and certainly not out of stupidity when you don't take all of the information into account. But the last of the four agatis, don't to make decisions out of fear. And when there's legislation which complicates these issues of euthanasia, when that legislation there, that creates that extra layer of fear, the fear of the legal consequences of these acts, which means you can't make a decision according to the Buddhist way. Whichever way you turn, when you know there's no such thing as a right decision or a wrong decision, there are different decisions which you make work, it takes away the fear. And when that fear disappears, then you can make wise decisions. So with each one of these problems which we have in life, really that we should try and have that freedom to choose wisely, with good guidance, with little rules to make sure we don't abuse our freedom of choice. Going on to the other, very quickly, the other very difficult issue which is related, the choice to have an abortion or not. Many people have come up to me and asked, Ajahn Brahm, I'm pregnant. I can't have this child. Should I have an abortion? And they may have asked you that question. What's the Buddhist idea of abortion? And first of all, there is a saying of the Buddha about the beginning of life. And if you read it very carefully, the Buddha said that human life begins when consciousness first manifests in the mother's womb. And consciousness manifests when the other of the five khandhas also appears, feeling especially. So when feeling, the response to pleasure and pain, is manifest in that being growing in the mother's womb, the first manifestation is the first beginnings of human life in the Buddha's definition. So, a embryo in a petri dish, does that show any manifestations of consciousness? Does that respond to stimuli with what appears to be pleasure or pain? And the answer is no. Consciousness hasn't manifested yet in the embryo, which means stem cell research is no problem at all for a Buddhist. That's not regarded as a human life. Later on, when the embryo develops into a fetus, when there is a reaction to stimuli, pleasure or pain is actually seen, it appears, it manifests, then you can say that human life has appeared. Before that time, and doctors have told me, before the neural system has developed, there can be no manifestation of pleasure or pain. So before that time, it's not considered to be killing a human being if you have an abortion early on. But even later on, when consciousness is manifest, and apparently you have maybe seen some videos of ultrasounds of abortions being taken place, and what gives most revulsion is when you see that little being apparently writhing and receding away from the knife or the needle or whatever else is being used to induce that abortion. There's a revulsion there because the being is experiencing pain. That is a sign that consciousness has manifested, and that is a human life. So that is breaking a precept. But again, there are times when that may be right. Which is why we don't have that black and white saying, all abortions are wrong. And the example which I give is the following. A few years ago when I was in England, staying with my mother when she was still healthy, I was watching the evening news with her, and there was a segment on the news which caught my attention. In a hospital, I think in Cardiff or Swansea, I still kept these two cities confused. In one of the hospitals in South Wales, there was a woman pregnant with two fetuses in her womb, and the medical condition was such that doctors were 100% sure if they did not intervene, both fetuses and the woman would die. However, if the doctor aborted one of those fetuses, the other one would survive and so would the mother. If that was you as a doctor, what would you do? Would you abort one of those fetuses so the mother and child would survive? Or would you think, aborting a fetus is breaking my precept, I should do nothing, thereby allowing three beings to die? What would you do? Put your hand up if you think that you would abort one of those fetuses. Most people say they would do that. You're not being unethical. There are these very exceptional circumstances when such an abortion would be justified. And that was one of them, I think, anyway. Certainly that choice should be there for the, in this case, the doctor. So these things are not simple matters. So when people say, what's the Buddhist view about abortion? Now we say it is not a simple matter. We don't sort of say like some religions, it is wrong. And sometimes I've said, what right has a monk to say it's right or wrong? I have never been pregnant. I don't know what it's like. But I know that a woman who makes that decision is making the hardest decision of her life. There's no decision which would be more hard for you to make than whether you should have an abortion or not. So as a Buddhist, as a monk, my role would never be to tell you what to do. My role would be to try and help you make that decision. Talk about the four agatis. Make sure you're not acting out of personal desire, ill will, delusion, especially not fear. And to tell you whichever decision you make, there's no such thing as a right or wrong decision. So you'll never be criticized. Too many religions, they work on fear and the guilt. And that causes huge amounts of emotional pain for a woman who is about to have that abortion. And afterwards as well. And that is totally uncalled for. Taking away the fear. Giving support. And saying whichever decision you make, I would always be there for you afterwards. As a friend, as a guide. So the woman would never feel the fear of rejection in case she chooses this way or that way. That's why wisdom and compassion. So instead of just giving these blanket answers, yet it's right, yes it's wrong, Buddhism has always had that sensitivity and nuance to be able to help people make these decisions in a wise and compassionate way. Take away the black and whiteness, because life isn't black. It isn't white, it's always grey, and in between, and mottled and speckled. That's our life. So again, Buddhism helps one make a decision, supports one afterwards. And by doing that, we can actually take these teachings and make them practical, you know, in our modern world. And if you do things like that, then you'll find that these teachings, they will grow in this world, become more popular, become more meaningful, because they're not just things which you just do as ceremonies. They are things which do change your life, and they do help you, they do serve you, They help other people solve many of the difficulties and problems in life. It's called wisdom. It's called compassion. It's called finding a way of having meaning in your life. So thank you for listening.